morning.
Hello.
Hey, can I get two of the blueberry muffins, please?
Ah, sorry. We're sold out of those.
Dang. I knew they wouldn't last long. Okay, how about a couple morning buns?
Ooh, just missed them. The person before you bought the very last one.
This is what I get for sleeping in. All right, how about two of the eclairs?
Our sale on eclairs has concluded.
What does that mean?
The product is currently unavailable for purchase.
So it's also sold out?
The sale has concluded.
What are you trying to tell me?
Thank you for joining us today.
Are you okay?
Please, help me. While you're doing that, I'll welcome everybody listening to this episode of Lucky Paper Radio. My name is Andy, and I'm here with my bro, my broski, Anthony Maddox.
Hey, what's up, bro? How you doing, bro?
Slightly different format for the intro in that I'm just calling you my bro, because this is our bro set review, bro.
This is a bro down, ho down.
Bruh.
Mm-hmm.
This is not good.
This is great. This is audio gold.
We need someone to save us, Anthony, and luckily we have another person on the line. It is, of course, Parker, my other bro, coming to us all the way from Philadelphia. What's up, Parker?
What's up, bros?
Nothing much, bro.
Man, it's so unnatural for us to say bro. It just sounds completely wrong.
Really?
It's alien.
You think it sounds weird when I say it? I feel like I feel perfectly natural.
Okay, good. I'm glad you feel natural. It sounds great, buddy. Keep doing it.
Check out my new Heelys.
Keep doing what you're doing. Wait a minute. Heelys are your first go-to bro reference?
Well, first I thought about hats, and then I was like, hats aren't cool. You know what's cool? Shoes with wheels hidden in them.
So when you think bro, you think like 11-year-old in 2001?
I guess I'm thinking like, hello, fellow kids kind of vibe.
That's not what a bro is at all.
I don't care.
Okay. Let's not litigate the details of what a bro is because we have a lot to get to. This is our bro community set review. That means we are reviewing the results of our Brothers War and Brothers War Commander surveys and talking through all the cards that cube designers are most excited about from across the community and across a span of different kinds of cubes. I always make Parker do the intro, but you know what, Parker? You get the night off. It's unfair that you come here, you know, a couple times a year, and I'm always making you do the introduction and explaining how this survey works. Basically, if you're just tuning in for the first time, and recent metrics show that a lot of people are tuning in for the first time. You know, we forget that every show is everyone's first show. So if this is your first episode of Lucky Paper Radio, when every new set is released, we conduct a community survey to determine which cards in that new set cube designers broadly are most excited about. That means that cube designers respond by indicating which cards from that set they are testing in their cubes and how enthusiastic they are about their inclusion. And they rate that enthusiasm on a scale from 1 to 3, with a 1 being extremely skeptical, but maybe I'll throw it a bone, give it a chance. A 2 being somewhere on the fence, could be good, could be bad. And a 3 being a card they are very confident is going to stick in their cube for a long time. Then we aggregate all those results and we look at them on a cool scatter plot on our website, on a page linked in the show notes, and a beautiful article that Parker has written. And we talk about them here on this episode to give our takes on the cards people are most excited about.
Yeah, and critically, this isn't a measure of power level or strength or anything like that that, you know, that matters for every other way to play Magic except for Cube. But Cube is really up to the designers, what they're interested in, what their taste is, what kind of experience they're interested in creating. So people might rate cards high or low for whatever kind of reasons. Maybe they just think a card's going to play well, but they're not going to like the art long term, so that might be a reason they might exclude it. Or they might give it a low rating because they're worried it's too powerful. So this is really just a rating of the community's taste more than anything.
Yeah, I mean, it could be a flavor-based cube, and they could be like, this card's going in literally no matter what it does, because this line of flavor text that just fits with the theme of my cube perfectly. So there's a myriad reasons any of these cards could be included, and what we're really looking at here is the average across all of the broad, beautiful diversity of cubes out there.
Yeah, you got it pretty much perfectly. I can just leave now if you don't need me.
Oh no, Parker, we need you. Did you hear that intro before we brought you in? We desperately need you here.
We need you, bro.
We need you, bro.
All right, bro.
All right, let's stop this bit now.
This is just the new me. I don't know what you're talking about, bit.
Parker, what I will still have you do is maybe run us down the overall impressions of this set in terms of popularity amongst cube designers.
Of course. So The eponymous brothers, Urza and Mishra, are having a little bit of a brother's cold war, I think it's fair to say.
Now, we only got one hot take. Is that a brother, brother's is war? Or
okay, shut up, okay? I'm being vulnerable and expressing that I don't know how some words are pronounced on the show. I'm being very brave.
You are brave. Sorry, just Parker. Like the
just
soldiers
making fun of me for not knowing how to pronounce brothers. I did a lot of Googling last week afterwards, and there is a little bit of people maybe that say the other thing. There's a little bit of question, but for the most part, no, I'm just wrong. Which is why I edited. You didn't listen. You don't listen to the show. I edited it in saying I looked this up and I'm very wrong.
Oh, great. That is brave of you.
Mea culpa. All right, sorry to interrupt, Parker. Anthony had to drag me. Very important content.
It's okay. So, yeah, this is a little bit of a brother's cold war. We only got one hot take for the show. The median respondent to our survey is only testing 9 cards. Now, I mean, it's not nothing. It's, in fact, about on par with Dominaria United, which was the previous set. But our respondents have only given, the median respondent has only given 2 cards from Brothers War a rating above 2.5. So there's only 2 cards at the median that our respondents are like confident in for their cubes. Again, this is firmly middle of the pack when it comes to our set surveys.
Yeah, I feel like we are kind of, I don't like to speculate too much about what goes on behind the scenes at Wizards of the Coast, but I feel like, you know, now that we're, what, like 3-ish years out from Eldraine, I feel like we're in the time period where they would have been designing this set during the fallout of all the powerful cards in Eldraine and maybe some of the fallout from Fire Design. And I feel like maybe we're in maybe a more conservative era of Magic card design in terms of power level, which does, you know, even though this survey is not about power level, I think that powerful cards do tend to make their way into more cube lists than less powerful cards, and there's a lot of reasons for that. But for whatever reason, I do think we're in a period of more conservative Magic design, which actually I kind of find to be a little bit of a breath of fresh air, a little bit. Like, I don't mind a set where I'm only testing a couple cards. It feels like I get a little break from the constant churn of new stuff.
Yeah, something else I would hypothesize is that, like we were talking about on the previous episode about just the cards that we were interested for our own cubes, there are a lot of cards in the set that just care about these really specific themes or have really specific mechanics like the Power Stones or like artifacts entering the battlefield in green, which is kind of a new thing that doesn't actually, even though I think these are cool mechanics and cards in themselves, don't necessarily fit cleanly in the environments I already have existing. So I could see that kind of novel design space actually making it, as far as first impressions go, a little bit less of a home run set.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. It could be that the cards in this set are appealing to a wide variety of players, but they just don't agree on which cards those are. For example, I actually loved these like huge mech-like robots. I loved them so much that I decided to make a cube on Arena that's based on like the film series Pacific Rim, the great motion pictures. And anyway, so I'm testing in that cube like 30 cards from this set, and they're all perfect because they're just these giant mechs, and it's going to go great with the kaiju from Ikoria, and it's going to be a great time. And so that's just one example of somebody who, for a very kind of idiosyncratic reason, is very interested in cards from this set. They just aren't interested in the same cards as the power-motivated cube respondents or whatever.
For sure. I mean, I kind of appreciate that read that maybe a reason that this looks like a little bit less of a popular set is maybe just our reach for the surveys is increasing. We do have hundreds of people that have responded, which means people are interested in a lot more unique, novel things. And I kind of love that, looking at the sort of long tail of, yeah, there are a bunch of people interested in this one weird specific card. And, you know, all the data that we've collected from the survey is published on the site. So if you're interested in seeing people's comments and thoughts on that, you can definitely go download that directly. Or, I don't know, if you're a data analyst yourself and want to take a stab at remixing this data and maybe finding other patterns we missed, that would be super cool to see.
Yeah, that's true for all the surveys out there. So if you want a big old database to work with, do some of your own analysis, by all means, dive in. Some sets, we have a kind of clear division between like the top cards, and then there's like a little break where like, oh, you know, a lot of people are testing the top 11 cards, and then there's kind of a gap between the 11th and 12th card. That's really not the case with this set. It's kind of a very linear,
classic rank frequency chart here.
Yeah, pretty much. It's a very linear like step between different cards all the way down the scale. And there's a few, you know, outliers at the top, which we'll get to, obviously, like the top 3 cards, basically top 2 cards. But for the most part, there's just like, you know, a percentage or two difference between all these different cards. So where we draw this line is kind of arbitrary. We're going to talk about the top 8 cards in this set. But before we get to that, I think we each have some cards we want to talk about that didn't make it into the top eight, but with it that we are dying to discuss.
Yeah, I'm going to start with the highest rated Power Stone card in this set. Or not the highest rated, but the most tested. This card is Horned Stoneseeker. It's one and a red for a 2/2 creature lizard. It has menace. It has, when it enters the battlefield, create a tapped Power Stone token. And when it leaves the battlefield, sacrifice a Power Stone. So, like I said, this is the most tested card that references the Power Stone token, which is new to this set. Technically, Karn from the last set like previewed it, but this is, you know, its first real outing. And Horned Stoneseeker is seeing play from a paltry 6% of our respondents, with an average rating of 1.9. That's a lot lower than I was expecting.
For this card specifically, or for the Power Stone mechanic?
For the Power Stone mechanic. I mean, you know, if it wasn't Stoneseeker, I had assumed that at least one card from the set would, you know, be appealing or novel enough that it would see more widespread play than 6%. And I think the reason that we're not seeing that maybe is a little bit of what you were talking about, Andy, where we might be in a post-Eldraine, post-fire design kind of world, and these cards aren't pushed on power level. I don't know. It may also be that the Power Stone token itself is less appealing than treasure or food or clues or the examples that we've seen of artifact tokens prior to this. Or it may just be like token exhaustion. I don't know. What do y'all think?
I mean, I wonder if just this particular mechanic might have been, in the way this set was designed, much more tuned towards limited, because I think it really works well in that context where there are a bunch of cards that are just sort of making incidental treasure tokens, and that kind of feeds into the artifact theme, obviously the scalable, like, prototype artifacts that then you can cast as huge things, giving you sort of a ramp effect from these common and uncommon interactions that are going to come up pretty often. But that might mean if you're not, you know, designing an entire cube about making that effect work in that way, it's going to be a little harder for these incidental cards to make a lot of sense.
Yeah, I have not been following Standard at all. I'm not sure if any of the Power Stone cards are making waves. I think I'd be surprised if they were, just because none of them stick out to me in terms of power level outliers. And we saw this a little bit with the Karn Planeswalker when it came in the previous set. People were all like, oh, this is bad. We don't like this. I think what you're saying is true, Anthony. Like, the Power Stones are tuned for limited, but I think they're also tuned for this context. And sure, in a context where you have a lot of things to do with colorless mana, all these cards that make Power Stones might be tuned with the expectation that the Power Stone's pretty valuable because you have a lot of stuff you can do with that mana, whereas maybe in a normal set where you don't have as many mana sinks, you don't have as many big colorless spells, the Power Stone's value goes down a little bit, and that sort of slight shift in just the relative value of it has a big impact on how popular the mechanic is. I mentioned on the show last week that I don't have any cubes currently with really an Artifact Matters theme, but I think if I did, I would still not be that into Power Stones, to be honest, because compared to Treasures, I think it's a lot less exciting. Treasure is cool because it allows you to, like, maybe have a little bit of a greedy splash, or like one of those like very light splashes we've talked about on the show before, or, you know, it's a thing that lets you have very explosive plays. The Power Stones are really, like, kind of slow and long. So many of them enter the battlefield tapped with all the cards that make Power Stones.
All of them in the set do, actually.
Every single one. It's just, yeah, I guess that's like a very conservative thing, right? Make them all come into play tapped, mm-hmm. So you can't possibly like start chaining things together and make mana positive spells. But yeah, I don't know. It feels like a very conservative application of this design. And even if I cared about making token artifacts, I think I would be much higher on treasures and other things before I'd be looking at these Power Stone cards, which are just, you know, it's just a colorless mana rock.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned Karn from Dominaria United, and I forget his epithet for that set, but it does remind me of the phenomenon of anchoring bias. You know, like you go to a used car dealership and they are selling you a car for, you know, $20,000 or whatever, and then you try and talk them down. And so when you get them to talk down to $15,000, you're like, hey, I got a deal. But they might have inflated that price in the first place to anchor you to think that it's worth $20,000 when it's really only worth $10,000, right?
Is that what they're doing?
Says Andy, who just bought a new car.
That seems so unreasonable and unfair.
I know, right?
So you're saying if that Karn, which by the way, I think that's actually a really cool kind of way to structure the sort of set design, is having this mechanic kind of splash in as a preview in a way that it didn't like look like it was going to be a whole mechanic for a set. I thought that was kind of a cool thing to do. But you're saying if just incidentally Karn had some other ability totally disconnected from Power Stones that made it a very powerful card, people might already just have a higher impression of it?
That is exactly what I'm saying. Since Karn, it's Living Legacy. since Karn Living Legacy did not make an impact in Constructed and had the word Power Stone on it, Karn might be kind of dragging the whole mechanic down with him a little bit, because cube curators look at the new set, they see a token, they tie it to their prior experience, which is Karn, and Karn, like an anchor, is dragging the whole...
Big, heavy anchor
big
holding
Big anchor
this
made
down.
Of... Wait, what's he made of again?
He's made of silver.
Silver.
I
right.
took me a second
it's
too.
Right, his name. It's right there. Yeah, I'm also reminded of... Anthony, you referred me to an episode of Drive to Work that I listened to yesterday, which is titled Designing for an Eternal World, Mark Rosewater basically talks about...
He says very deliberately, he doesn't say what you're about to say.
Dude, no, I mean, here's the thing, like... That episode is so apologetic. Like,
yeah.
The amount of times he says, I'm not saying this, I'm not saying that, when he's just saying, it's fine, you can say it, Mark. He's basically talking about the challenges of designing for Commander, frankly.
Yeah.
I mean, Magic for a long time was focused on Standard. That was what they designed cards for, and the rest kind of flowed from that. And so when they were designing sets, they were always thinking about what's going to be in Standard, what's the limited environment going to look like, and that smaller pool of cards was a much safer place to take risks, right? They could kind of swing for the fences, and if they, you know, messed up and something was a little too good, you know, look at Eldraine and Adventures maybe, you know, eventually Bonecrusher, Giant, and the rest just cycled out, and, you know, it was maybe a little bit annoying in Standard for however long that was, but that was just one sort of blip on the timeline, and now we're on to the next thing. Now, with Commander being a huge focus of R&D, they have to be really careful to not power creep things, not print broken cards, even more careful than they normally are, because once they print a broken card, that's it. That's broken. I mean, they talked. He talked specifically about Smothering Tithe. He's like, white's not supposed to make treasure tokens, but we made one white card that makes treasure tokens, and it happens to be one of the best cards that makes treasure tokens in EDH, and so now all we get is requests to make more white treasure-making cards. And so I think this conservatism is definitely coming from somewhere, and Power Stones are an example of something that could definitely be kind of cracked in Commander,
yeah,
a much
true.
Slower format with a lot of big spells, so I could see them designing this for Commander and saying, hey, let's just make all these come into play tap so we don't have any kind of problem where, you know, some card's taking over Commander and we have no control over that ban list. Like, there's a lot of considerations here.
Right, and I think that just calling it being conservative is exactly what it is, and I think he talked about it in another episode about the design of Brothers War, that they like these Power Stones, but just because they were worried about Mana Rocks can be powerful, they were just like, you know what, let's just take it easy. If these all just enter tapped, it's not going to really impact Limited all that much, and it's just going to put a safety valve on it being broken in other constructed formats.
So I think there's a lot of factors to why the Power Stones are perhaps not that exciting. I think this individual card is kind of cool. It reminds me of Alpine Guide, which was that uncommon from Modern Horizons I thought was kind of cool.
Yeah.
That tutored a mountain into play,
like,
and then when it left play, you sacrifice
a
mountain, where it's like a little bit of a push body with like this upside that then when it leaves, you lose the upside. I think it's kind of interesting. But I'm not surprised this is not a hugely popular card, and I guess I'm not that surprised to see the Power Stone cards also panned by the cube community. I want to touch briefly on Teferi Temporal Pilgrim, which you all heard me last week in real time realize that actually I did in fact like this card quite a bit, and I did add it to my cube. We played a little bit with it on stream last night, and I'm definitely into this card. The more I've thought about it, the more I definitely like that it presents a fast clock. If you get to do the thing, it turns the corner very quickly and can kill your opponent very quickly, which is something I value because I don't like my games to drag on too long. Even though control decks want to go to the long game, there's different types of long games, right? There's long games that go long because you've successfully stifled your opponent, and then you're just kind of like waiting to find your win condition. And there's long games that go long because neither player can really profitably do anything, and you're just like hoping something happens. So I like this for sort of filling that role. The other thing I'm actually really excited about here, which I honestly can't remember if I talked about this on the last episode or not, is that I think it's the kind of card that will be a good win condition for control, because if you're drawing cards more than once a turn, this card gets a lot better. And it's also not going to be the kind of 5-mana planeswalker that like a 4 or 5 color deck is going to happily just sort of slam as a greedy sort of top end. It'll be fine. I mean, it's not bad. It draws a card every turn. It makes a decent token, but it's really going to be maximized to decks that are drawing lots of cards, which I think are going to be decks that are heavier blue, have more cantrips, get to abuse things like Brainstorm. And for that reason, I think it's going to be a little more appealing as an actual dedicated control win condition, which I think is one of the hard things about control win conditions, is finding ones that are not just going to get also snapped up by the greedy 3-color deck and just run in a soup pile.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's cool that it is a little bit more of a build around. It's not just this thing that comes down, protects itself, and then generates value slowly in a very linear way. It really interacts with what else you're doing and gives you a couple different decisions that, I mean, I think it is that nice amount of being a build around that is going to just function differently in different decks, and I think that's a cool feature of it. I was really disappointed that I didn't get to cast a Brainstorm with it in play ever, but...
Well, you're too greedy. You cast other spells instead.
I know.
This did come up in our streaming. I think that this is kind of a six drop in a lot of situations, mm-hmm. if you can afford it, right? You're really going to want to, like this was a young Pyromancer or a Monastery Mentor or something, you're really going to want to play this and immediately have some other way to draw cards. Maybe that way's on board, right? Maybe you have an activated ability that draws cards or something. It doesn't cost mana to activate, in which case this looks really appealing on five. But if you're just running it out on five without any other ways to draw cards, it's not hugely appealing on that first turn. But it has the advantage of if you draw it in late game with seven mana or whatever and a couple cantrips in hand, then it could just go really dummy the first turn it comes into play. So I'm higher on the card now, and I think I'm pretty excited about it, even though I look at every Planeswalker with a little bit of skepticism these days.
And it is being tested by 15% of the respondents to the survey and has a pretty reasonable rating of 2.1, so it's not like no one's interested in it, but it's not the slam dunk all-star that we've seen from a lot of other big Planeswalkers.
We don't often see that from Planeswalkers. I think you are misremembering.
It's possible.
Planeswalkers, in general, not that popular. There's a lot of players that just don't like them. And cut out that portion of cube designers that don't play with Planeswalkers for whatever reason, it's hard for any other Planeswalker to rank very highly.
True.
I remember we had this conversation on the Cube Discord ages ago, and we ended up like searching Cube Cobra for the most popular cards of different types. And at the time, the most popular Planeswalker was Chandra, Torture, Defiance.
That sounds right, yeah.
And I think it was in just like shy of 20% of all the cubes on Cube Cobra. And compare that to, like, Lightning Bolt or something, which I think was in 65% or something like that. Like, the Planeswalkers overall, not that popular.
I mean, we have to mention again Scrapwork Mutt. This doesn't quite crack the top 10.
We don't have to mention it, but you have to mention it.
We've got to. I have to. I really just continue to enjoy this card. It's being tested by almost 20% of the respondents, so I'm not alone in loving this card. It's also got a rating of 2.1 on
Do you think
average.
That's the Anthony Maddox bump?
No, I don't think so. We could analyze it. We could go check of the responses. We got most of these responses before we released the podcast.
That is true. Right? That is true, yeah.
I mean, I think this is just definitely one of those cards that obviously fits into the set's mechanical themes, but it's just so open-ended and flexible that it's going to fit in so many different contexts. It's also, if we look just at the commons, it's the second most tested card, so I think this is really getting a bump from a Peasant and Pauper cubes.
Yeah, I absolutely agree there, and I just want to like compare this to some recent Enters the Battlefield loot or rummage effects, whatever it's called. For example, Fisher Wizard from Zendikar Rising is one in a red for a 2/1 that has the ETB from Scrapwork Mutt where it rummages, but it does not even have Unearth. So like, I don't know.
Garbage.
This might be
trash.
The best.
Even Unearth?
No. So like, yeah, I mean, this is just like several bumps of power level above the next best Fisher Wizard effect.
This is definitely quietly pretty pushed, this card.
Yeah, it really is.
Like it compares very favorably to other cards that are similar in the past. And it's not the kind of effect that I mean, I guess we have seen it printed at Rare on Rixmadi Reveler, but Rixmadi Reveler has all that other text on it, which I think it accounts for its rarity rather than just the baseline text there. I had thought more about this card, and I especially do like the rummage ability on a thing with Unearth, because I feel like what's going to happen very often is you're going to like play this on curve or whatever, and you're going to rummage the way you normally rummage, where it's like, this is a card I don't need now, or have like one too many lands or whatever. Then it'll trade in combat, or it'll die or something. And what you can do then is just, you always have this 2-mana rummage as a spell. Like, and sure, it gives you a 2/1 haste that you could swing in with, but like, it's just always sitting there waiting for use whenever you draw that land you don't need, or, you know, really need something else to do with your turn, which I think is a cool play pattern.
Yeah, it's also, I'm curious a little bit, I think that Constructed informs a lot of cube designers' impressions of cards much more than Limited, but this is also one of the top cards in red in Limited in the format, which could have some effect.
Could be. I'm going to make you talk about Zephyr Sentinel, Anthony. This is the most popular white main line we've ever tested, and you haven't even uttered its name yet. This is one in a blue for a creature human soldier. It's a 2/1 with flash and flying. When it enters the battlefield, return up to one other target creature you control to its owner's hand. If it was a soldier, put a +1/+1 counter on Zephyr Sentinel. Now, here's my argument. It's a white main line. We know you love those.
It's true.
It cares about a type line, which you also tend to like lightly splashing tribal themes, and you have a couple changelings and stuff in your cube. You like the occasional type line matters as long as the floor is there. I think you don't like this card because it's too good, and you don't like powerful cards, and you're just pushing it away.
What? That's not at all true.
Okay, what don't you like about it?
I think it's up to one. That's my guess.
That is a downside.
No, it's not. It's an upside.
It's an upside in terms of making the card more powerful. It's a downside in terms of making me have affection for it.
Why do you have affection for...
Because this is just an upside. It's not a downside that you turn into an upside.
Okay,
it's such
a more clever feeling. I can appreciate that.
But you know what? Okay, we are going to talk about some more soldiers, or at least soldier token making cards in the set, and maybe this will make it into a future cube project. I think soldiers is a little bit of a weird type line to care about. And I don't know, something about the...
Oh, you heard it here first. Soldiers are weird. Anthony doesn't support the troops.
There's no cube that I currently have where soldiers would be meaningful, and I think that unlike some... Tribal is really difficult, where the balance sometimes just looking at the floor and the ceiling of a card, sometimes it's like, oh yeah, this is a card I'm going to play, but if I get a relevant creature type that's a little bit of a bonus, that's going to be great, but I don't necessarily need that. I feel like on this card, I really, really want that bonus, because a 2-mana 3/2 flyer that also potentially gives you some other upside is like really, really powerful, and I think losing that point of power is a big, big downside in terms of how powerful this card is. So I think that this is really going to signal you want to have some other soldiers in your environment, and that doesn't describe any environment that I have right now. I think that's where I'm at.
I don't buy it. I think a 2-mana flyer is roughly on par with the environments that you are curating right now.
Right. Like, no, I think that
if
I just
put
this...
This is how you get people to play a white main line.
If I put this
in
my regular cube, I think it would be powerful. I think that if it just didn't have that +1/+1 counter text, I would like it a lot more. I think that it's because people are going to look at it and say, oh, well, I don't have any soldiers. I'm seeing that...
You've never said this about any of the zombie payoffs in your cube.
That's because there are a bunch of zombies. Like, you can reach for that.
All right, this was still nagging me, so I went and I checked the regular cube list on Cube Cobra. Right now, Anthony has 17 zombies across the entire cube. You want to guess how many soldiers? 16. So Zephyr Sentinel will be the 17th soldier, exactly the same amount of support. Checkmate Atheists. Oh, boy. This guy will bend over backwards to not play powerful cards.
I don't think that's what's happening here.
Okay.
Also, I don't have to bend over backwards. I can just sit here and look at it and not pick it up and put it in a cube.
That's true. You are well within your rights, but if you want people to play and be excited about white man lines, the card type you enjoy, you should make it a little above the power level of your
cube. I've written
it
right down here in my note.
I'd be thrilled to take a Zephyr Sentinel in the regular cube.
All right, here we're also going to go ahead and pull up Cube Cobra and do a little filter on soldiers.
Note that he never... ever says how many he found. See? He knew. He stayed quiet. All right, well, we're talking about how Anthony overlooked Zephyr Sentinel, a clear, obvious slam dunk in the regular cube. I do want to mention briefly Soul Partition, which is a card I was really high on, and then I got quite a bit of feedback, I would say, after last week's episode that actually this card is bad and it's unplayable, and what was I possibly thinking? I said my part last week. I won't say it again. I do think this is a really good tempo removal spell. It doesn't get rid of the thing forever, but it makes them draw a bad version of that thing, namely a version of that thing that costs 2 more mana. And there's a lot of time where they're just going to kill them before they get to cast it anyway. It's not a control card, and I think people look at removal spells and they're like, I want my removal spells to be control cards, and so maybe that's something that's unappealing about this. People were kind of rating this as like a bad unsummon, and I think it's quite different from that, even though it does still let them cast the card from their hand, right? Like, I don't think people look at Elite Spellbinder and say that's a bad duress, right? It's a different kind of effect that still has a taxing tempo effect on the game.
Yeah, it's interesting just scrolling down the list. There's a little bit of a mismatch here where it's still being tested by 15% of the respondents, but its rating is only 1.8, which stands out as a little bit lower than the things that are up there in terms of number of people testing it. So I think a lot of people are they're interested in it, but they're a little bit skeptical because it is a difficult card to evaluate.
Yeah, personally, I think in cubes that I curate, I'm going to be playing Fateful Absence over Soul Partition, unless something really unexpected comes up. Just because Fateful Absence, sure, it can't hit any non-land permanent, can't hit your own stuff effectively, but it does downgrade whatever thing is exiled into like 1/3 land, because some of the times they're going to crack the clue and draw a land, and that is a much worse replacement generally than a version of the thing that costs 2 more mana.
Yeah, it's question is how much better or worse is a thing you removed than the literal average card in your opponent's deck. Like, take all the cards, average them together. How much better or worse is it than those? And certainly, if you're thinking as like a control deck and you're removing one of their really important threats, then yeah, that's probably one of the most important cards in their deck that you most don't want to see again. It's where the tempo comes into play. I think it matters, right? Like, if I'm just using it to get rid of your two drop that's going to block so that I can attack in this turn, and now you don't have another thing to play because you can't play your two drop on turn three because now it costs two more mana, that's where I think it gets pretty appealing for me.
Yeah, I think it's funny. I think maybe this is how you described it, actually, where if you, let's say I play a, well, Ravenous Chupacabra's not a great example because of the ETB. What's a average creature in your mind?
Grizzly bear.
Great, a grizzly bear. You would maybe put a grizzly bear in your deck in whatever format, but you would never put a 4-mana 2-2. Like, that's an awful card. So saying, I'm going to get rid of your average card and replace it with an abysmal card makes sense. That seems like a good trade. But I think the reality is, sure, if you have a 4-mana 2-2 and you have nothing else to do, like, that's still going to be a relevant card in your hand or in that gameplay, even if it's a terrible card you would never want to put in your deck. And I think that making that switch is actually a little bit difficult but meaningful.
I also think that Soul Partition's value goes up relative to other removal spells the more resource-constrained the format is. So,
yeah,
I don't know, if the white decks are playing Wastelands and they're playing Thalia's and taxing the opponent's resources in a significant way, then Soul Partition goes from, it's going to hit its ceiling more often where it removes a thing and that thing is completely uncastable. It'll also be disproportionately better in formats that support Reanimator because you can exile a reanimated thing and they won't be able to cast Gristlebrand for 10 mana ever, right? So,
yep. That is also true of bounce effects, though. Though if you bounce it, they have more of a chance of being able to discard it again and maybe do the whole thing again. But once it's in exile, their only option is going to be to cast it. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, really good against delve threats.
Contextually, there can definitely be some additional value here.
I guess you could still delve the thing from exile, right? If it had a delve and it was also...
Because it just
two
says,
you'd have to pay with actual mana, but you could still delve things away?
I don't think... Yes. I think you could pay all of it with delve. I gotta read the card.
You can even delve the tax from Soul Partition?
You can evoke and pay the tax.
Who
it's
knows?
It's a little weird.
We're not judges. Look it up, people. I guess the last thing I'll mention in terms of cards that didn't break into the top eight is... We talked a little bit about Lay Down Arms. This is that white removal spell that removes a creature with mana value less than or equal to the number of planes you control. And I was a little bit critical of it, I think, on the last episode, or at least my initial excitement was tempered strongly by my experience not running Defile and being totally okay with that. I'm still a little surprised to see it so low on this list, though. I know, for example, Ryan Overturf included it as his number three top card from the whole set for cubes, and to see it so far down this list... It's only being tested by 12% of our respondents with an average rating of 2, so I guess people are equally unexcited about this card as I am.
Yeah, I'm not on it. I don't know. What do you want us to say?
You don't have to
the enthusiasm is palpable.
It's a card about peace in a set that has war in the name. This
Get
is not
here,
what
peace.
I signed up for.
We're ready to war.
Yeah.
Well, with that, should we move on to our top eight, gentlemen?
I would call it one more card. Not that I'm surprised to see it down here, but just I think it's an interesting sort of interesting feature of the way that this survey is. Yoshin Dissident, I think, is one of the most interesting cards to me in the set. It's green and white for a 1/1. Whenever an artifact enters the battlefield under your control, put a 1/1 counter on target creature you control, which is sort of the signpost for this whole new theme in the set of green-white caring about artifacts entering the battlefield, which I think is just a really cool way that they are granting green a way to care about artifacts. I think that was like a big part of the challenge of this design that was all about artifacts and how do you make green do something. So it's only being tested by 6.7% of the respondents, but it does have a pretty high rating of 2.2. So I'm really curious to see how this card and some of the other green cards that care about artifacts in a new way end up evolving long-term when we're looking back in our set retrospective.
I agree that this Dissident is extremely interesting from a design perspective. Like you mentioned, Anthony, traditionally in artifact-heavy sets, green has been really like left out in the cold.
Right, it's either just the pure hate color that's balancing against everything else or doesn't really have its own identity.
Right. And you know, we've gotten some exceptions to that rule. I'm thinking of Carapace Forger, who was a little Metalcraft Tarmogoyf lookalike or Watchwolf lookalike from Scars of Mirrodin. So, you know, it's not that we've never gotten such cards, but I think we've gotten these cards at a higher density than ever, and especially in a way that explicitly cares about artifacts positively in green. And I think that's pretty new.
I want to point out here that one of these green artifact matters cards actually showed up in Constructed already in a big way. Serinth Steelseeker, which is one and a green for a 1/2 creature, human artificer, scout. When an artifact enters the battlefield under your control, look at the top card of your library. If it's a land card, you may reveal it and put it into your hand. If you don't put it into your hand, you may put it into your graveyard. This was in a deck that Aspiring Spike 5-0'd, I think it was an RCQ with, which was a, you know, Feasting Troll King, Asmo, Underworld Cookbook food deck that uses...
That deck keeps popping up.
Well, it uses, Seraph Steelseeker to just, like, smooth everything out. Every single food that comes into play, which is a lot with that deck, you just get to churn through your deck, you get to bin more Oval Chase Daredevils to get them back. It, like, makes the whole deck really come together, and so I know that at least he's kind of cautiously optimistic that could be a, maybe, you know, tier 2 fun brew that is making use of this weird uncommon.
Yeah, very cool. That's sick. That card's way down the list, only 3% of respondents. So, yeah, I'm curious to look back and see if people's opinions change on those kinds of cards.
I mean, the only reason I know all this is because I like saw him tweet something like, this deck is real, and it had Serinth Steelseeker in it. And I was like, what
is that card?
Well, why is this deck real? And I like watched some of the video because I wanted to know why this card was playable in Modern, and it's pretty interesting. Without any further ado, let's go to the top 8 cards that are tested by the most cube designers from across the cube design community. I think you should take number 8, Anthony.
I'm happy to. So we talked about this in our cube inclusions episode, but this card is Bushwhack. It's 1 green for sorcery. It's choose 1, search your library for a basic land card, reveal it and put it into your hand, or target creature you control fights target creature you don't control. I am a little bit surprised to see this so high up on the list just because it is kind of a fight spell. At the same time, it is very flexible. It's kind of being compared, I've seen it, to Abundant Harvest or...
I reject the comparison to Abundant Harvest. People that are comparing this to Abundant Harvest can fight me.
They might bushwhack you.
Bushwhack me, bro.
All right, whatever.
You ever just bushwhack with your bros?
All the time, bro. Oh. Anyway, so I am excited to see this card up here. I think maybe it might be largely the impact of, again, people that are designing Peasant or Pauper cubes that are looking for these more flexible cards and looking for removal in green. So I think it's a cool card.
I mean, I think we have maybe an answer to your question of, like, will people put this in their deck? If 24% of our respondents are interested in trying it in their cube with a rating of 2.1, I think that bodes very well for people putting it in their deck in the regular cube.
Yeah, let's all enjoy a bushwhack, I guess.
I mean, it's worth noting, comparing it to Tailswipe, which was only tested by like 15% of our respondents, I still think Tailswipe is the better card. I could be wrong about that. Maybe I'm just wrong. But ultimately, right, it doesn't matter what I think or what the objective power level of the card is. The whole point is you're trying to get fight spells in your cube people will put in their deck.
Right.
And this is obviously not a perfect analog, right? Cube designers putting it in their cubes versus drafters of a particular cube putting it in their deck. But this, to me, indicates that overall the sentiment towards Bushwhack is a little more positive than towards Tailswipe. So maybe this is going to solve that problem for you.
Yeah, and another thing I think that's worth pointing out is when we look at modal spells, one of the biggest things that influences the power level of it is how different those modes are in terms of when they're useful. And I think that these are very, very differently useful when you want a land or when you want a fight spell. And even though there are plenty of times where you don't want either, those are still very different use cases, which covers a lot of space in the game.
Now, bro, I have to set the record straight a little bit on Bushwhack.
Speak on it, bro.
A couple weeks ago, Anthony, you said you didn't get the flavor. The first mode is you're taking the lay of the land quite literally, and you're setting the ambush, right? And then the second mode is you sprigging the ambush and bushwhacking somebody. So,
if you think, is that what bushwhack
means? I don't
think
that's what bushwhack. Bushwhacking just means cutting your way through forest, which. Sure,
no.
you're gonna go in the forest and you're gonna find some monsters. That's gonna happen. You're gonna get into a fight.
What if it was called Bushwhack Whack Bush?
I'm going to Merriam-Webster right now to look up Bushwhack.
This is gonna
first
be some
bushwhack,
this is
then
gonna
you
be
whack
some
the bush.
New kind of spell, like new card kind of frame format where each spell has two modes, but the words are just mirrored.
Palindrome.
I don't
frame.
Know how. Yeah, palindrome frame. That's gonna be great.
First definition of bushwhack: transitive verb to attack someone by surprise from a hidden place.
Wow.
AKA
wow.
Ambush.
Man.
Get wrecked.
Brand new to me.
The dictionary
never challenge Parker on something if you looked up in a dictionary. This bro is a nerd. He will get you every time.
Are you going to check him on this? He could just be completely lying.
No, I'm not going to check him, but we have a lot of listeners. They'll do it, and they'll probably just side with him.
All right, well,
what.
I think that's enough bushwhacking, bro. What do we got next?
The next card
is... Whacking around the bush.
Mwah, oh. Chef's kiss. The next card is Phyrexian Flesh Gorger. This is 7 mana for a 7/5 artifact creature Phyrexian Worm with menace and lifelink and ward. Pay life equal to Phyrexian Flesh Gorger's power. And it has prototype for 1BB, which makes it enter the battlefield as a 3/3 instead of a 7/5. I think this is pretty inarguably... Well, no, I'm not going to say that. I think this is a very pushed prototype card. One of the most pushed ones in terms of just raw power level. And in terms of power level, I think it gets there in a lot of places. I see all that lifelink and I'm like not interested. I've had my years of playing Cube with Wurmcoil Engine and those years are well behind me. But not surprising this is appealing to people because it is just a powerhouse of stats.
Yeah, I mean, 3 mana, 3/3, menace, lifelink, ward, that is a lot going on. And that even has flexibility on top of that. You can even blink it to make it huge. So yeah, it's not surprising that people are drawn to it for being exciting and powerful.
I have found the ward cost on Sedgemoor Witch, which is very similar to the ward cost here, to be a much bigger deal than I originally thought it would be.
Oh, yeah.
Like, when I first looked at that card, I was like, okay, well, the ward cost is just like a little, you know, doesn't consolation. Even slow you down. A little consolation if you get your thing removed, right? It's just like a tiny little, like, bone that we're being thrown here. But there's a lot of times where that life really matters. And the whole point of you putting pressure on your opponent and playing your 3-drop is to get their life total lower. And they're like, well, I guess I have to remove it. I've seen it dismembered, which was a net total life loss of 7, wow. Which was a lot to lose to get rid of something. So that really does add up. And so, you know, just a 3-mana menace lifelink, pay 3 life if you want to target it, is a lot.
I mean, especially if you factor in that if this is in an aggressive deck and it has menace, sometimes you're just kind of damned if you destroy it and damned if you don't. You're just going to take that damage somehow.
Yeah, I think this card has a lot of kind of those classic elements that are catnip to our survey respondents. It's a callback to an iconic card to some extent. It's a worm, and it's got a bunch of stats like Wurmcoil Engine. It also offers novel synergistic hooks like this blink thing, like the artifact thing. And then it's also just a big creature to be cheated out in cubes that support Reanimator or Tinker or whatever. And I think all of that kind of combines to make a recipe that's pretty appealing for almost a quarter of our respondents. Yeah.
Yeah. I think if you're down with lifelink and you're in the market for a big 7-drop, that's like a huge haymaker, this is one of the top ones I'd be looking at.
Andy, you are the weird one for not liking lifelink.
Look, I'm going to start a movement here. I'm going to get people behind me on this.
I definitely respect and understand your dislike of lifelink, even though I'm much more tolerant of it than you.
I mean, it might sound overstated on the show. I do still have a fair amount of lifelink in my own cube, despite my predilections against it. It's just that a card that gains life has to really earn its keep.
I will point out, though, that even though a couple more respondents are testing it, it has exactly the same average rating of 2.1 as Bushwhack. So people like it just as much.
You can come out of the bush and whack this worm.
Well... Every episode is someone's first episode, and if you come back and listen to us again next time, I appreciate it.
Parker, tell us about the brand new Skull Clamp on the Block.
Okay, the brand new Skull Clamp on the Block is also known as Transmogrant's Crown. It's 2 mana for an artifact equipment. Equipped creature gets +2/+0. Whenever equipped creature dies, draw a card, and you can equip it for 2 generic mana. Or a 1BB. I think it's much, much worse than Skull Clamp, but that's probably a good
I should
thing.
Hope so. That's a very good thing. Yeah. Talk about mistakes they made once that they probably won't make again.
I want to say this is fixed Skull Clamp, but it's more just like Skull Clamp before they broke it.
That's a deep cut there for people that listen to a lot of drive to work. I do think this is the spirit of what Skull Clamp was meant to be. I think if people think it's going to be remotely as powerful, they have another thing coming because it is not going to be anywhere near as powerful. But at the same time, you know, it's relatively cheap to play and equip if you're playing black, and basically says, go ahead, trade with my threat if you want. I'm just going to draw another card and you're going to be down a card, presumably, unless you're trading with your Baleful Strix or whatever. Definitely going to be a menace in long games, I think, and allow you to keep putting pressure on because you'll be able to justify otherwise foolhardy attacks with the consolation of drawing a card if your creature trades in combat.
It reminds me a lot of Heirloom Blade, but it only works like Heirloom Blade if you are mono black. Otherwise, it costs 2 to equip and that kind of stinks.
You don't have to be mono black. You just have to have some black mana sources in your deck. Yeah.
Yeah, I actually like that feature a good bit.
That's a good comparison.
A lot
too.
Of these sort of equipped, colored, discounted equip abilities where it's like, I'm going to put this in a black deck more readily than I would another deck, but I can still play it in other contexts. And I think that is a really interesting sort of balanced decision as you're building decks, especially when we're talking about like splashing and things like that, where maybe I would want to just pick up a couple extra black sources to be able to play this. I think I do think this is a good card. I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of people are actually interested in this that don't play Skullclamp, that think Skullclamp is a little bit too powerful, and they are looking for something that is actually meaningful in like a sacrifice theme that isn't just a card that I'm going to play in every single deck that happens to make some 1/1s. So I think it being a little bit more narrow could actually be a feature for a lot of cube designers.
Yeah, good point.
I do love the Heirloom Blade comparison. And I agree with you, Anthony. I like the colored versus slightly more expensive generic activation for equipping it. But I would say, in a cube that features this card, I think I'm very unlikely to put this in a deck that doesn't have black mana sources. But I really like that still as a fallback where, like, if I don't have black mana, I can still equip it, right?
Yeah.
So even if I'm playing in my deck that's a black-red deck or whatever, if I don't have a black mana sitting around, I can still get something out of my card instead of having it be dead.
Right.
And that modality, once it's in my deck that does have black mana sources, which is where I want to play it, is still very welcome.
Yeah, I mean, it helps that in almost every context, this is going to be a card you're going to most want in black decks anyway. So it sort of fits together as a whole design, not surprisingly. All right, next up we have Recommission. This is 1W for a sorcery. Return target artifact or creature card with mana value 3 or less from your graveyard to the battlefield. If a creature card enters the battlefield this way, it enters with an additional +1/+1 counter on it. This is the first one that's being tested by actually more than a quarter, a little more than 25% of our respondents. But similarly to these last couple, it has a rating of just around 2.1 on average.
This card definitely jumped off the page at me, I mean, in terms of the raw rate. I love these small reanimation spells. I love my unearths. We got a hot take to this effect talking about the value of these kinds of cheap reanimation spells, specifically in like a Mardu Pyromancer-style deck, where you're playing cheap cards like Young Pyromancer, like your Monastery Mentor, like your Sedgemoor Witch, stuff like that, that are still really high value, in which case this reanimation spell, it's getting back a small thing, but that small thing is a big part of your deck's plan.
Train Master GT's hot take.
I think the two most interesting cards from Brothers War 4 Cube are Recommission and No One Left Behind. I think both these cards do a great job of supporting the Unearth deck, quote-unquote, referring to the card Unearth. Unearth has been a very, very powerful cube card, especially in non-singleton environments for years. It has great synergy with a lot of the small reanimator effects, or specifically a lot of the things that trigger off of instants and sorceries being cast, primarily things like Young Pyromancer and Sedgemoor Witch and Monastery Mentor. All three of these cards really, really work well with these little instants of sorceries that you reanimate a small thing for a very small mana cost. They act as sort of protection for these key cards and can let you really start snowballing with value from your non-creature spells, which red, white, and black all have very, very high quality non-creature spells that you want to be casting, and they're relatively cheap. I think No One Left Behind and Recommission slot perfectly in this deck. I don't think they act as substitutes for Unearth if you are singleton. I do think you probably want to be non-singleton on Unearth proper if you are planning to support this archetype. However, I think these are great additional support pieces, and No One Left Behind especially is exciting because it is just like a fine playable for normal like Sultai mid-rangey reanimator decks as well. You know, sometimes you don't want to spend 5 mana to rebuy your Archon of Cruelty, and just spending 2 to regrow a Tarmogoyf is perfectly fine.
I'm not surprised to see this so high. I think it's a really cool and awesome card, and I hope people have fun with it because it's really sick.
Yeah, and at Common, I'm sure a lot of Pauper Cubes are excited to include this as well.
I'm also really excited for this card. I think relative to Unearth, we lose a mana of efficiency just in terms of like how much mana we can possibly cheat or recoup or whatever. But the thing we get instead is the ability to recur an artifact, which is not nothing, or return a creature with a +1/+1 counter on it. And I think that's a really cool ability that offers additional synergy. I'm like pumped to reanimate a Thalia, Guardian of Thraben, and use that third power first strike.
Oh, you're thinking too small. Think about Swiftblade Vindicator, Parker.
Okay, also
a card
Swift
you don't
Blade
play.
Vindicator.
Think about it.
Okay. Or like, I don't know, Territorial Kavu and make it a 6/6. Now that's really exciting.
That's a Parker move right there.
Oh yeah. So yeah, I think it's simple enough and it offers a pretty open-ended set of deck building and play incentives, and I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I do think when you compare it to Unearthed directly, like, I'm a big fan of Unearthed in my own cube. I'm not playing Recommission. I think that one mana difference, you know, it's 100% mana difference, right? Like, it costs twice as much as Unearthed, and I think that is one of the big values of it. The other thing I really like about Unearthed relative to this is that it's never dead, right? If you're at a part of the game where you have nothing to reanimate, you're not left with this card that doesn't do anything in your hand, which can be a big cost. I do love the fact that Recommission can get back artifacts, and I think in a cube that has a bunch of self-sacrificing artifacts like eggs or spell bombs or something like that, this is really appealing. It doesn't quite fit my cube, even though I do like the kind of small reanimation effects that are really efficient. The doubling the cost is a big hit to the efficiency, I think.
I don't know, Andy, because, like, I mean, going back to that Thalia, Guardian of Thraven, a 3-2 first strike is about a mana above rate, or like about a mana of additional value on top of Thalia. So I think you're getting paid back at least in part on that extra generic mana. It's just dependent on how well you can make use of that counter.
You are, yeah. I think that definitely depends on the environment, and part of the reason I'm so high on Unearth is that I'm hoping in most cases to do much more important things with an extra mana than get an extra power and toughness to my creature, right? Like, if I am reanimating a young Pyromancer, I then want to also cast a removal spell and then get my elemental immediately and stuff like that.
What about Dreadhorde Arcanist?
Okay, now you got me thinking.
I like that.
That's very cool.
That's cool.
You can't see Parker's video, but he just literally did like a little orphan Annie, like, you know, put his palm under his chin and look at the sky willfully. It was beautiful.
Thank you.
I do love that effect of this, right? Even buying back a one drop with this, you're not going to feel awful because you're probably going to get about two mana worth of a card, even if you get back a one drop. And obviously, you get back a three drop, you could potentially make some very powerful three drops by putting another plus one counter on there, especially with cards that have flying, other keywords like Parker mentioned. So yeah, it's there. The thing that really gets me is also, in addition to the efficiency, just the fact that it is a dead card sometimes. And
yeah, that's the biggest thing.
I need my cards that are dead sometimes to really be worth it when they're not dead, you know?
You can just discard it to Scrapwork Mutt.
There you go. Get your Scrapwork Mutt back with it. Now it's a 3-2.
Yeah.
Then it dies again. Then you unearth it. That's three Scrapwork Mutts, baby!
I mean, you could just name more reanimation spells. We can have as many Scrapwork Mutts as you want.
I didn't realize how this worked out, that I end up talking about all these stupid big prototype cards. All right, the fourth most popular card from Brothers War 4 Cube is Arcane Proxy. 7 generic mana for a 4/3 artifact creature wizard. When Arcane Proxy enters the battlefield, if you cast it, exile target instant or sorcery card with mana value less than or equal to Arcane Proxy's power from your graveyard, copy the card. You may cast the copy without paying its mana cost, and it has prototype for 1 blue-blue, under which circumstances it enters the battlefield as a 2/1.
That is a lot of words.
I mean, it's a lot of words.
I think the effect very much makes sense.
The effect is simple. You got to read it once, but you probably don't have to reread it a bunch of times.
If I know Magic players, we sure won't.
Parker, anything I talked about this card last week, I want to hear you weigh in on it. The most popular prototype card in the whole set, the most popular artifact in the whole set, in an Artifact Matters set, is it deserving of such high placement on this survey?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not going to play it myself. I have Snapcaster Mage. I have Seagate Stormcaller. Snapcaster Mage has the advantage of being iconic, which means people don't have to read it. They already know it.
And also a lot better card.
You know, it's also got a bit of history with if you get the version with Tiago Chan's face on Snapcaster Mage. So, it has some major advantages over Arcane Proxy is the point. And then Seagate Stormcaller also has about as much useless text on it as Arcane Proxy in terms of its kicker, but I don't know. I already own it, and I don't have to chase down an Arcane Proxy. So
that's a great feature, which I'm sure applies to many of our listeners.
Yep. I'm just not on it. I don't find that the complexity is something I need at this moment. My cube doesn't need an additional Snapcaster effect, and I think I'm better served spending my three drops on other kinds of effects. I don't know, Innocuous Insect or Brazen Borrower or just, you know, different things, not all Snapcaster Mages.
You know, it's interesting. We were talking earlier about this effect of, you know, if there's something comparable, it might just make you like it less. Maybe that's a little bit of a different effect than we were talking about earlier. But I feel like this would be a lot cooler if Snapcaster Mage didn't exist to a degree, because Snapcaster Mage is such a clean, tidy, very like powerful, flexible card that plays really well, plays with a lot of high, interesting variants because it's going to do different things depending on what's in your graveyard. And this has all that too, but I don't think the amount of added complexity adds that much exciting value and exciting gameplay. But I mean, it's still a cool card that's going to do a lot of interesting things at the end of the day.
I think ultimately its cost is similar to the cost of a Seagate Stormcrawler, which we should mention, Seagate Stormcrawler not overwhelmingly popular in cubes from my impression. I could check the Cube Cobra numbers, but you know, obviously much less popular than Snapcaster Mage for all the reasons mentioned. But I think the big thing for me about Snapcaster Mage relative to a Seagate Stormcaller or an Arcane Proxy, I mean, obviously the flash is the key difference, but what that mechanically does for you is it allows you to play it in a control deck, which I really don't think you can do with Arcane Proxy or Seagate Stormcaller and be super happy. Maybe a tap-out style control deck that's committing a lot more to the board, but if you're looking to play reactively, Arcane Proxy and Seagate Stormcaller are pretty much just going to be Maul Drifters in your deck. Maybe they're occasionally get back a removal
still,
spell.
Yeah, buy back removal spells. I think you can still be reactive at sorcery speed.
Yeah, but I
not
don't
to the same degree.
I don't think you want this taking up a slot in your reactive control deck unless you are like really deep on cheap removal spells and like that's your whole plan. The thing about Snapcaster Mage is like it's just so great to be able to like sometimes just flash it in and like kill an attacker
just
because
blocking, yeah.
Because that's what you need to do at this time. It's like that simplicity simplicity makes it so flexible that both this and Seagate Stormcaller just have a lot less of that. And yeah, I don't know. I was a little higher on this last week than I am now. I do kind of think I'm coming down on the Parker side of like this is similar enough to Stormcaller that I think it's one or the other for me. I don't think I want this many mostly proactive storm callery style effects in my blue section, and I run very few blue creatures because I do think they have to clear a high bar of inclusion given how much I love blue spells and how flexible all those blue spells are because they can be played in all kinds of different decks. I guess it's like if you really love Seagate Stormcaller, here's another one for you. And
Then
obviously it has all of the artifact synergies if your environment does care about artifacts.
And like that's just the trade-off, right? You get to add an additional bit of power to your cube, or like a different kind of power to your cube, but you have to weigh against that, is this card, like, is its additional value worth the complexity of a new card that is unfamiliar to my players? Maybe it sets me back, you know, $15 or whatever, and that might matter to some of our respondents, and so on and so forth. So, like, it's a trade-off, even a card as obviously throwbacky and powerful as this one.
We are talking a little bit about sort of like power level trade-offs between similar cards, but I feel like absent that, we could also just think about these differences as features and why a designer might choose one or the other. Maybe you're just not as interested in supporting, you know, control decks. You're not as interested in a card that is just so flexible and so easily picked into any kind of deck. Maybe you do really want more proactive, sort of tempo-oriented cards, and this just makes a lot more sense to the kind of gameplay that you're interested in curating in your environment. And I think that if you are trying to sort of curate that little bit more mid-rangey, tempo-y blue deck, those decks might also be much more interested in having a little bit of an out if they get flooded and end up in the late game and can use a 7-mana spell that maybe buys back a Factor Fiction or something cool like that. So
yep.
I could definitely see all of that being features as much downsides to the right cube.
Yeah, and that
absolutely
puts it right in that Seagate Stormcaller territory. I think I agree, in that deck, that's a very cool card, and there's lots of reasons to want that in your cube.
All right, in third place, we have Loran of the Third Path. 2 and a white for a 2/1 legendary creature, human artificer. Loran has vigilance. It has when Loran of the Third Path enters the battlefield, destroy up to one target artifact or enchantment. And it has a tap ability. You and target opponent each draw a card. So Reclamation Sage got color shifted and got a little bit of a glow up. And by a little bit, I mean a lot of a glow up.
A lot. It took me a minute to realize what I was looking at because there's so much going on in this card.
Yeah. Like, this is a lot of upside. And I also think white is maybe better suited to use the Reclamation Sage effect. Is that true? I don't know if that's true. But it is certainly welcome for white. It's not something that white has access to before. And combined with this additional upside, that makes Loran appealing to almost a third of our respondents with an average rating of 2.3. So this is the number 3 card in the Brothers War.
Do you think that most people who are putting this in their cubes are just seeing this and saying, great, finally, White Reclamation Sage, let's go, that's all that's necessary? Or do you think that some of these other, I mean, specifically this symmetrical card draw is like very unique, and I don't think that's an effect that we would see this high in terms of the survey ratings.
Yeah, I think it's certainly a marginal benefit in the sense that you put this in your deck to be a 2-for-1 in order to kill a thing. And then the additional card draw on the tap ability is bonus. It's like, I don't know, I'm struggling to think of a marginal upside ability. Oh, it's like the Monstrous on Fleece Mainline or something. It's not something that you expect to activate every single game. The reason the card is played is for, I think, the Naturalize effect.
I do think the effect is kind of interesting, though. Obviously, like, it's probably mostly designed for multiplayer, where you target the opponent that is least threatening, and you basically are, like, drawing cards without a huge cost, and I think that's a kind of a cool interaction in multiplayer, that you're helping somebody else out and balancing the game. I think even in 1-1, this effect could come up sometimes, though. Like, if you're playing against an opponent that just has 6 cards in hand, and you're down to nothing in your pretty aggressive white deck, them drawing a card is not as big a deal as you drawing a card, because you have no other resources, and they are probably more constrained by mana resources than card resources. So I think that there are going to be games where this could be relevant.
I do think this card is high on the survey, pretty much just because people are seeing it as a White Reclamation Sage. Yeah. I do think White generally is better positioned to take advantage of this effect, only because it's better positioned to take advantage of that cheap body. You know, I think that the destroying it, artifact, or enchantment, fine. Each color benefits from that probably roughly equally. But in your green deck, your Reclamation Sage, maybe it gets in for some damage, maybe it doesn't. Most green decks in most cubes are not trying to race their opponent really quickly and get them dead. They're not an aggro deck. Here, you know, if your opponent tries to play some stabilizing artifact or something, or an artifact creature to try and block, and you lure into the third path and then get in, that 2-1 is much more relevant in a really aggressive deck than it would be in your average, like, green mid-range or ramp deck.
That's a great point. I do want to point out, while we're here, Lauren does a lot of things, but it does none of them best in class for white. We've got Skyclave Apparition and Oblivion Ring for very flexible interaction at 3 mana. And I mean, there's also interaction at other mana values, which is, you know, useful in other situations. We've got Adeline and Thalia and all kinds of aggressive threats if we want to push damage. And we've also got card advantage, like Planeswalkers that cost 3 mana, or Wedding Announcement, or any number of mid-range threats that offer better, not one-sided card advantage. So I don't know. Personally, I'm not seeing the power of Lauren of the Third Path, and that leads me to suspect that people are either playing her for reasons other than its power level, or in addition to its power level, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, the more that we talk about it, I think the exact, you know, mana cost and power and toughness is just such a clear callback to Reclamation Sage. I think that must be a huge influence to people's choice about this card.
Well, so I think if all I cared about was the disenchant effect on a creature, I would probably be much more interested in Cathar Commando in your average white weenie deck.
That's
the
true,
2 mana 3-1 you can pay 1 and sack it to disenchant something. It's got flash too, which is really valuable, I think. This card is actually making some waves in Legacy a little bit. I mean, right now the Legacy world is kind of overrun with the recent introduction of the initiative cards to MTGO, which has been dominating the discussion around, like, the Death and Taxes archetype.
That's hilarious.
But this card is slotting in, I think, quite nicely to that deck for a couple of reasons that we haven't brought up yet. So it's a legendary card. If you're playing Caracas, this is a recurring Reclamation Sage, which does give it some upside over other options. It's also a way to protect it, obviously, which is nice. Also, the symmetrical draw, I don't think it's going to come up in cube that much, but people in Legacy are playing it alongside Spirit of the Labyrinth, which says your opponents can only draw one card each turn. You just tap it on their turn. They don't get to draw a card. You get to draw another card. And it's got Vigilance, so you can do that while you're attacking
right,
them down for life total on your own turn. So, sorry, I just can't help myself. This is probably never going to come up in any cube ever either, but the other reason that Lauren is seeing some Legacy play is because it allows you to stifle your Doomsday opponent's win by responding to their Thassa's Oracle trigger and forcing them to draw a card from their empty library, thus killing them before they win on the Oracle trigger, which is very cool. So if you have a self-mill Thassa's Oracle deck, maybe Lauren is a response to that. These upsides, I think, could definitely come up in the right cube environment. The Caracas one, I think, is going to be pretty common. Caracas is still a widely played card. I personally don't understand why. I think that card is miserable to play against if you have any legends in your cube. But this is the kind of situation where I think Caracas can be very cool. When you kind of draft around it, you specifically draft legends with end of the battlefield abilities, and you can reuse them. Yeah, I think people are mostly ranking it high because there's still this reputation Reclamation Sage has as kind of the de facto disenchant on a stick, and finally getting it in white is exciting to people. I think people are also interested in maybe trying to find some utility in these edge cases, and some cubes definitely will.
Yeah, I'm curious, more and more as we talk about it, curious what that symmetrical card draw can do and if there are other ways to abuse it. Like, I definitely can see white-blue decks abusing it, again, like just preventing that second card draw. But potentially, even there are, you know, cards that give you a benefit when your opponent draws extra cards that you could abuse. Or, I don't know, maybe you just mill them out. It's not a choice. It's a forced draw.
Right. I mean, Spirit of the Labyrinth, I don't see in many cubes, but we see Narset, the War Planeswalker, in quite a few cubes. So this little side case might come up more often than we might think.
There's also Hull Breacher, and in black we just got Dogged Detective, which is not exactly commonly played, but it's really cool. Yeah, so there are definitely synergies.
All right, next up, our number two card. This is a big jump up in terms of number of testers, with 51% of the respondents giving this card a try, but the rating is still only 2.3, so high but not stellar. This is Recruitment Officer. It's one white for a creature human soldier. It's a 2/1, and it has 4 mana. Look at the top 4 cards of your library. You may reveal a creature card with converted mana... I'm just reading it wrong. With mana value 3 or less from among them, and put it into your hand. Put the rest in the bottom of your library in a random order. I'm not super surprised to see this way up here, just because it is another one in a series of 1-mana 2/1s in white that we see pretty consistently with, I think, a pretty substantial upside. So
I'm surprised not to see it higher, to be honest.
Really?
I mean, we had Usher of the Fallen at like 85 or 90% of our respondents were excited about Usher of the Fallen. And there's a lot of factors that could be at play here. Like you said, Anthony, maybe our reach has just gotten wider such that we're finding more cube designers that are not following the classic white Savannah Lions aggro archetype, and so we're getting more people that are not caring about this card that otherwise might.
Which, if that's the case, I'm delighted.
It's also possible that, you know, we just keep getting these cards and we're finally at a critical mass where people are like, cool, but I've already got the ones I like for my cube, which is kind of where I'm at, even though I wouldn't say that I'm so committed to that aggro archetype as other players. I think I only have, we established, like 3 or maybe 4 white Savannah Lions in my cube.
Yeah, I'm also in that portion of cube designers who's just like saturated on 1-mana effects with marginal upside. And I think at this point, actually, I think this has been true for years now, that even for cubes pursuing the peaks of power level, we can still choose which cards we like best out of similar effects. We're not like, Recruitment Officer is not so much better than vanilla Savannah Lions, that if you prefer Savannah Lions, you can still play that and it will be perfectly fine and it won't really change your power level.
This is one of the rare circumstances where I actually would love to see time traveling supercomputer numbers of how a Recruitment Officer over a Savannah Lions actually affects win percentage. And I think playing it a bunch, you might develop an intuition for how often you actually get to activate it, which you could argue is the upside and that's when it matters. But if that upside is never changing the outcome of games, then was it really upside, or was it just more actions you had to take on your way to the grave, you know? So I'd be really curious to know exactly how much it would affect it. And I would guess it'd be very marginal, the amount of times you would actually win a game. Yeah, I think Parker's right. I think it's like you get to choose, and the overall impact on power level is pretty small.
I see what you're saying about sort of the story of, if you were going to activate this in, you know, a very classically powerful card where your strategy is play a bunch of 1-mana 2/1s, if you're at the point in the game where you're going to activate this, you've already lost, is kind of the story you're telling, which
a little
makes
bit.
A lot of sense to me. But at the same time, if you're going from, oh, I have nothing to do, to now I potentially get to draw a bunch of cards, yeah, there are plenty of games where this is just not going to be meaningful, but that is a huge difference in just like the amount of stuff you can do to potentially keep in the game. So I think there are going to be a lot of those in-between games that this is going to swing. I do think that this is a powerful effect, and I also think it's a fun effect.
It's a cool card. To be clear, I'm not saying that that's... The story I'm trying to tell is not just one of an aggro deck that I don't think can win once it gets to the point where It's got 4 extra mana to dump into an activated ability. I just think this is a really bad rate. 4 mana to maybe draw a small creature off the top of your deck is not good. And if you have this in a deck that has bigger creatures, then you can't draw them with this ability. And so that card has to be in the top 4 cards of your library, and it has to matter in a board state where you could afford to pay 4 mana to not affect the board at all. Now you're going to draw a small creature. Is it still going to matter? Sure, you can definitely concoct situations where I draw my Fairy Guide Mother, and now I can use Gift of the Fae to give my big threat flying, and then I get to swing in for lethal.
Sounds great.
You can construct those situations for sure. I just don't know how often it's really going to matter. And ultimately, it doesn't matter, right? Like, who cares what the actual win percentages are? If you like the card, as you do, Anthony, then you should play it. And I do think people are going to, to the Bushwhack point, Drathis has put this in her deck a lot more than they would a Savannah Lions because it's new, it's shiny, and it has this promise of potential late game value.
Yeah, I mean, I think that maybe my regular cube where I am going to give this a try is kind of the perfect environment for it, where you don't necessarily really want to play a 1-mana 2-1 in most decks in my cube, but like you said, if you have it on turn one, it is going to be relevant and effective. So the fact that this is either that on turn one, or, you know, you draw it on turn five and it's a 5-mana 2-1 that draws you a card, or, you know, maybe it still, you know, gets in there, it has some relevant board impact, but then on turn eight, you know, you're flooded out and suddenly you're getting a little bit more advantage to, yeah, like, get some reach, draw some Fairy Guide Mother or other way to get your opponent dead. I think that it is actually going to function pretty well in that specific kind of context.
I can even imagine situations where it actually negatively affects your win percentage because choose to spend mana activating the ability.
Always giving your giving players more choices can negatively affect their win percentage because they will have opportunities to make mistakes.
Okay, well, but
that is true. That's
look at it this way. Like, it might not even be a mistake with the information you have, right? But it could still have retroactively been the wrong decision. You know what I mean?
No.
Okay, so let's say you've got, you know, something else you can spend 4 mana on, and you've got your Savannah Lions in play, and if your only option is to cast the thing you can spend the 4 mana on because you have no other options, you just do it. And if you have this in play and that 4 mana option, you... yeah, you could choose the wrong option.
Look, I'm glad I could be your rubber duck there.
You could choose the wrong option, but it might be the right option at the time, but obviously you shouldn't ever choose the, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the story isn't like, when is Recruitment Officer, when is its ability useless in the games that White Aggro was already going to lose? I think the story is, when does Recruitment Officer win you the game? Like, it hits a card, that card is relevant, that card changes the tide of the game, so you weren't already going to win, you were going to lose, and that changed to a win. That's the marginal power of Recruitment Officer, and I think that marginal power is...
Yeah, I mean, I think that the games that this is going to turn are the games where you've played an attrition battle with your opponent, you're both kind of exhausted of resources, maybe you have plenty of mana, but you're both just out of cards, and this gives you an out for, okay, now I'm not, you know, going to lose to top decking one more land than my opponent, I actually can generate enough advantage to close out this game.
Which
and
is real.
I think that's
but...
real. That's a, it's not a lot of games, but it is some games.
I think
right,
maybe
it's
the,
not a lot of games.
I think maybe the thing that tips it over for me is that it just doesn't compete with any other... like, in an environment where you're playing this card, like, if your opponent has anything else that's designed to get late-game card advantage, it's going to be better than this. This is, like, bad. Anyway, here's a question for you.
Oh, here, I spent 4 mana, and I drew another 2-2, and you played Uro. Yep, I'm going to lose.
Look, here's my point. So, how often do you think this ability would be activated in my white monocolored starter deck if I replace all the Elite Vanguards with Recruitment Officers?
I've got to say, like, that has been influencing my thoughts about this card, playing games with those decks, even though that's obviously a very specific context, which maybe isn't relevant here. But just the games I played with it last night, I would have loved to have this because
you
I was
never had
that...
4 mana left over. I watched you play.
Oh, I had. Remember I was putting all those swords on those guys?
Yeah,
and I was
but you're using
removed?
Your mana to put equipment on your creatures.
I got really lucky that I kept drawing swords and I kept drawing, like, again, like, it, the games came down to, am I going to top deck one less land than my opponent? Because if they top deck a threat first, I'm going to be dead. So, yeah, I think that I would have activated these many times in games similar to, but not identical to the games that I played.
I hereby vow to put these in my starter decks and play them there and see how it changes.
Do it.
I think I have a much better, much more complete understanding of how a Elite Vanguard or Savannah Lions plays in that deck than I do in the average cube deck.
Sure,
because that
sure.
deck is a much more controlled context. So because I understand and can control the context, making one small change is easier to measure than, like, I put this in my cube and then it gets drafted in a deck that is never identical to a previous deck that was drafted with Savannah Lions in it. And so, like, how can we actually compare? So I'll try it out there, and we'll see if I can have my mind changed. I mean, again, I think it's a good 1-mana 2-1 with upside. I think it's one of the better 2-mana 1-1s with upside we've ever seen, but it's definitely not going to take me off of the ones I'm on, and I think if you like any other one better, then the difference in terms of power level is pretty marginal. That brings us to our number one cube card from The Brothers War. What's that card, bro? Tell me now.
So number one, bro.
And that is, of course, Third Path Iconoclast. This is being tested by 56% of our respondents, and it has a very outlying high rank of 2.6. Nothing else in this whole survey ranks higher than 2.3, so if you go and look at it on our cool little graph, you can see that it is standing proud all on its own. And it got there with this rules text. This is blue and a red for a 2-1 creature human monk. Whenever you cast a non-creature spell, create a 1-1 colorless soldier artifact creature token. This is the Young Pyromancer plus we talked about previously. Triggers on all non-creature spells instead of just instants and sorceries, and also makes artifact tokens, which is an upside in a lot of different cubes.
I mean, it's going to work on both sides with all the Artifact Matters cards because it triggers on non-creature artifacts, and it also is going to make more artifacts that things can potentially care about.
Yeah, so relative to Young Pyromancer, you're paying a more difficult, more stringent mana cost. And the thing that you get in return is a more open-ended input to its synergy, any non-creature, and then a more open-ended output, a soldier artifact creature token. So I think it's a neat little package of synergy and an upgrade that is real, but it still comes with a cost. And I really like it for that reason.
Yeah, and of course, for cube designers that really love Young Pyromancer and want to keep Singleton, it just gives you more options of cards to use. Overall, I would just say this is really kind of the iconic kind of card that we always see rise to the top of the survey, yeah. Where it is something that is very much a known quantity. It is cheap in terms of mana cost. It's very powerful. And the fact that it's also an uncommon means it's available to rarity restricted cubes, a lot of them. It makes sense that we see this so high. And it's also really tying back and mimicking a really iconic classic card that gets played in so many cubes. So, yeah, I don't know if I have a lot to say about it other than it makes sense to see it here. And this doesn't fit in any of the cubes that I currently have, but I'm potentially looking for a home for it.
Yeah, I would echo that. It's absolutely a classic example of the cards that succeed on our community set surveys.
Which doesn't mean they're the best cube cards. It means they are the cards that are best for the most cubes. But
or at least appealing to the most cubes. Right. We will find out in the retrospective in 1.5 years if it was in fact best for the most cubes.
But of course, exactly. What's really exciting is that wide, wide range of all kinds of weird cubes.
It's true. I think there's a couple things we didn't talk about this card last week. So one potential side grade or upside you could even argue of this is that in a lot of cubes, people consider Young Pyromancer already to be kind of like a secret blue-red card.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
I think there's something to be said for having that be explicit on the card if that is how you envision it to be drafted. So if you as a cube designer don't think Young Pyromancer is playable in a red-green or a black-green or a white-green deck in your cube, then maybe this is a nice way to just take that understanding you have of the environment and communicate that to your drafters by saying, look, here's literally a blue-red card, so put it in the blue-red deck. That's what it's meant to do. I think that's a valuable design knob that people have at their disposal with this card.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, and I honestly can't remember the last time I've seen Young Pyromancer outside of a mono-red or blue-red deck.
Personally, I love playing Young Pyromancer in Mardu decks, but...
Oh, that is true.
Yeah,
that's
say sometimes red-black is pretty common in my cube because there's a lot of good cheap spells in black. It's also worth noting this card is already showing up and constructed in shells that would never play Young Pyromancer because of that non-creature instead of instant or sorcery trigger. So for as much as we're talking about it being superficially kind of similar to Young Pyromancer, there's definitely a lot of cubes I can imagine that would never want a Young Pyromancer that will definitely want this. I mean,
so
it's showing up in like...
it can be a replacement for Young Pyromancer, but it can also be a totally different thing.
A brand new card that a cube never had access to before, right? The deck it's seeing playing in specifically the most, I think, is this modern Breach deck that plays like 20 artifacts and very few instants and sorceries. And the whole point is just to use this to play all your artifacts and get more artifacts. It's an Urza Saga deck that has a full Urza Saga package. And so now you have this card that like... plays with Urza's Saga and like does things Young Pyromancer would never do. So I don't want to gloss over it as just like a cool side grade to Young Pyromancer because in some cubes, this is going to be a very different kind of effect. And if you do have an Artifact Matters cube and maybe you did overlook this as just a Young Pyromancer, maybe you don't want that effect, maybe look at it again, because the fact that this does trigger off of all your spell bombs, all of your little eggs, all of your little dinky stuff, I'd be pretty excited to play this in the turbo queue, I'm not going to lie, even though it's 2-whole mana.
It's tempting, yeah.
2-whole mana, but it's a good payoff for 2 mana. I heard somebody talking on some podcast, I forget which one it was, I listened to so many podcasts, about how they didn't know what the third path was in Third Path Iconoclast.
I was also confused by this, because obviously the place I've heard it before is Felden of the Third Path,
right.
Which I love that card, it's so flavorful, and I always assumed that the third path in Felden of the Third Path was an option different from life and death, because he's talking about in the card the story of his wife passing and trying to recreate her as a robot, so it's like, okay, cool. I mean, that's what I really love about that card, is you sort of get that whole story just from the little bit of flavor
elegant.
Text,
you know,
really excellent illustration. But I don't think that's true. I don't think being a robot is the third path.
I hate to say it. It's not. Let me clear this up for you.
Oh, good. Great.
Felden has been reprinted in this set, kind of, as Felden Ronam Excavator, which is further down the list. It's a cool card, but we didn't talk about it. Felden is married to Lauren of the Third Path. The Third Path is the side of the war that is not Urza or Mishra.
That's what I assumed, was that it was not taking
so the third
side.
Path iconoclast
or robot.
Is,
yeah.
It's just the neutral, it's the Switzerland, or I don't know. Switzerland is fighting still. It's like.
Yeah, and my understanding is also they were just taking a very different approach. They're this group of wizards that are taking a very different approach to magic, and they're not as much about giant big robots and more about actually casting spells and being cool wizards, which. I mean, I honestly just love the Brothers War flavor. Like, I haven't gone back and read the novels or anything like that, but you'd get so much of the flavor from the cards, and I find it to be super compelling. Like, this sort of sci-fi, big, massive robots, and this idea of, well, why would magic coexist with machines? Well, it's because people don't know how to use magic yet. They're working on it. They're learning. And one of the ways that they're doing it is digging up all these old artifacts and using magic to infuse these machines and having this other faction that's saying, hey, there's this different approach to magic and we can actually learn and improve in a different way. It's super flavorful to magic, and I like that.
Yeah, it's very cool. I did not play during this time, but this set is just dripping with flavor, and it's very interesting to kind of come upon as somebody who's new to this era of lore.
It's funny. I'm not a big magic lore person. I was playing back in like the original Urza Saga days. I was a child. I'm not a reliable narrator from that time period because I was 8, but whatever. I was playing back then, and I'm not convinced that like this is a more compelling story than modern magic stories, but I think there's something to be said for the fact that even if the story was awful, it has like a real world history now. Like it is the early days of magic. And even if it was like a totally hokey story, it's the magic that a lot of people working at Wizards now grew up with and like had their own ideas about. And now they get to actually like manifest those ideas. Like it's become a thing unto itself because it already has so much actual Earth 1 history, right? Because it actually, you know, makes sense on our sort of timeline as having real history.
Yeah, I mean, it also just has a lot of depth, even if that depth is not to your taste or isn't like the kind of sophistication you want from a work of fiction. It is real depth, and I feel like it is so much more compelling than a lot of the recent sets like Amonkhet or Kaldheim that are just sort of like, hey, we're gonna grab
Amonkhet was like 6 years ago.
Yeah, it was recent. name another one, Strixhaven. It's like those all feel like they're
name
really
a woman. Name a woman.
I don't know what that is.
I'll show you afterwards.
Just sort of starting with, hey, here's our one headline. It's like magic, but in ancient Egypt, magic. But with Norse mythology, magic, but wizard school, that is effective. That is a good way to get people interested and to understand a set, but it isn't, to me, compelling in the same way of, hey, there's like magic robots, and also there is so much depth, and there's going to be all kinds of characters, and you're not really going to know what's going on. Maybe I just like that. Maybe I like just being in the mix of not really knowing what's going on, but seeing that, knowing that these characters are part of something bigger, it's not sort of just this like one-off or copy-pasted.
Maybe it's like living in this era of so much rehashed and throwback media, mm-hmm. but I find
it
something
funny because this is also throwback rehashed media, but
fair,
in a way
fair,
that
fair,
feels
fair.
Much more earnest, and it is. Being recreated and celebrated.
Well, I was going to say, I feel like I'm drawn to anything that just clearly has its own mm-hmm. voice. Like you said, even if I don't understand it, even if it makes no sense, I'm like, a new thing. Look, new stuff.
Instead
of just Spider-Man 8 or whatever.
Spider-Man 27.
I mean, I guess we're literally talking about Dominaria 5, so I don't know if this argument really holds up.
No one said we're consistent in our being humans.
Yeah.
It's a cool set. I mean, it's interesting looking back, to tie it back to the survey, that there aren't a ton of cards that are being tested by a huge number of people, but there are a ton of cards that are being tested by a couple people. And I think a lot of cards that will end up finding homes as these cards just end up having a little bit more of a life in constructed formats, in limited, and people end up, cube designers end up digging through and figuring out what they want to do with these cards.
Yeah, maybe Serenth Steelseeker becomes a modern staple, and then we see it in cubes a whole bunch when people try and replicate its success.
Anything could happen.
It's been a pleasure talking about Bro with my bros.
Yeah, bro.
Yeah, bro. In that case, that brings these three brothers to the end of our Brothers War set review episode. This also concludes our three-part review of Brothers War in general, so if you haven't listened to the first two parts, go back and check them out, both our themes and mechanics and overall impressions episode, as well as the cards Anthony and I are testing for our own respective cubes, and there are quite a few of them. As a quick reminder, we have started streaming again with more regularity, and I have, as of today, put the first couple videos from our stream up on YouTube, so if you didn't have a chance to catch that, you can find them on our YouTube channel. We're going to link both in the show notes, and if you're around Monday evenings Eastern time, stop by and hang out, and if not, you can check out the things on YouTube afterwards. You know, when I first got into Cube, it was because of the Magic Online Vintage Cube and watching LSV and others draft it on YouTube, and I think that's how a lot of people got exposed to Cube, is either playing it on the Magic Online system themselves or watching other people play it, and I really want there to be just a bigger wealth of cube gameplay showing a diverse set of cubes available to people that are just like, oh, cube is interesting. What if I search cube on YouTube? What shows up? I'm on a little bit of a mission to make more paper cube content and put it on YouTube. And we have a lot of cubes in our playgroup. We're going to have special guests most weeks, I think, maybe bringing their own custom cubes through. This next week is going to be the Brea cube. So the day you're listening to this, tonight we'll be playing the Brea cube with the Brea cubes designer, James. And then Parker, you got to come down sometime and bring your own cube and we'll got to put you on the stream.
I would love that. And, you know, I will say I got to pop in as a viewer the other day, and it was really nice not only to see my Baltimore friends, but also I got in some free testing by, you know, by fiat watching, I think it was Anthony playing Teferi, the new one, and I got to see it in action, and it was really cool.
You got to see me play it and my opponent remove it a couple times.
Well, it's funny, like, I think we still learned a lot
from
that.
You do still learn, because you see it in play, and it's like, oh, that is the threat now, like, even if it doesn't stay in play.
You see it in play, and you know what you can literally do next turn, and you're like, well, okay, the prophecy has come to fruition. If I, in fact, get to my next turn, I will be brainstorming with Teferi in play, and that will be broken. And so, like, even though it did get removed, you could tell you were on the cusp of that promise, which, I don't know, there's something so much different about actually just having a card in a deck
and playing
it in a game of Magic that totally changed your perceptions of it, so...
It's unfortunate the brainstorm was just underneath, actually got exiled by the Primordial Mist, so it's not like I knew about it, knew I'd be able to do it the next turn. I think I didn't have a sixth land in my hand, which really affected my sequencing.
Oh, you had way more lands in play, because you played Teferi and Fairy Miscreant on the same turn, and I thought, why is he doing that? He should, because Fairy Miscreant also has Flash.
Well, but because I wanted to play that, it's very Vandal.
Sorry,
I wanted
Fairy
to play
Vandal.
That and then activate Teferi to get the counter. I was counter greedy.
Yeah, I think definitely the line there was keep the mana up, play Teferi, make a token.
I think it was not make a token, but...
Oh, I think it's make a token.
Anyway, if you want
it
more
died because you didn't have a token.
This banter, check us out on stream. It's going to be a good time.
And that's it for this episode of Lucky Paper Radio. All of our music is produced by the one and only DJ James Nasty. All the Magic cards are produced by Wizards of the Coast. This show is produced by just three bros. Chilling in a Zoom call, 6 feet apart because they're not gay. I don't know if you know that meme, Parker, but it's a meme.
It's a meme.
I'm not a homophobe. being gay is cool.
Hey, and we should give a big post-credit thanks to everyone who submitted the survey. This wouldn't be... I mean, this is a great resource, I think, to everyone looking back on the set in the future, and we really appreciate everybody who takes a legitimate amount of time to go through and fill that out, and we also really appreciate all the comments that help sort of inform our conversations about this.
All right, Anthony, while we're still on the line, I'm going to show you do you know the 6 feet apart because we're not gay?
I know that one's a classic.
You know that Vine. I'm going to show you the Billy Eichner thing while what's his name? Parker's still on the line. I think he could be able to hear it too.
Is the recording over?
It is no, not, not for
this
us.
This is B-roll. Is that what this is?
Okay. Here. This is
B-roll away.
This is my
miss
favorite.
For a dollar. Name a woman.
Name a woman?
Yeah.
Who? Who?
No, name a woman.
Name a woman?
Yes. Yoga bag. Name a woman.
Sorry.
No, name a woman.
Name a woman?
Yes, go.
Any?
Yes.
Oh my God.
Yes.
Why is this so hard?
Name a woman. Name a woman! Name a woman!
It's so good.
That's what we call deer in the headlights. That's how brains work.
I don't love everything Billy Wagner does, but man, do I love that clip of him walking around New York City giving $5 to anyone that can name a woman.
Is there a lot of this? Many people, when put on the spot, cannot name
Nobody is as good as this woman who literally for 27 seconds just... And then she just panicked and ran away because she couldn't name a woman.
I would not have lasted. I would have run away much sooner. Who are you?
I believe in you, Anthony. I think you would have been able to name any woman.
I thought of a couple.